This podcast was originally recorded on September 12, 2019, as part of a live meetup with the founder of Indie Hackers, Cortland Allen. Parts of this podcast may no longer be up to date. The original meetup included references to a screen share, which you can find on our YouTube channel linked in the description. Indie Worldwide hosts multiple live meetups and live streamed interviews with indie founders every month. You can find links to our next meetup at indieworldwide.co.
Hello, and welcome to back to Indie Hackers Worldwide. My name is Anthony, and I'm calling in today from a secret underground location in sunny Montreal, Canada. Our featured guest with us today is none other than the founder of IndieHackers.com, Cortland Allen. How's it going today, Cortland?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing good, man. Thanks for being here. Quick overview of the format. Today's meetup is going to be an hour and a half. We'll start off with Cortland's story about how he founded Indie Hackers. And after about 20 minutes, we'll switch to an open Q&A where anyone who has a question can feel free to ask. If there's any time left over at the end, we can use it for either round-robin introductions or do breakout rooms. This meetup is being recorded and we'll upload it sometime tomorrow to the new worldwide YouTube channel. Stick a link to that in the chat. And there's also a link in the chat for the Slack group if you haven't yet joined us there. With that said, Cortland, the floor is yours.
Cool. Well, thanks for inviting me. I didn't prepare like a super long speech, so I'm just going to be talking off the cuff about Indie Hackers. And so, is there anything you guys really want to hear about? You just want to like hear me tell my story? Do you want to hear me talk about like the early days, like way before I started Indie Hackers? Do you want to hear about like things after joining Stripe? What do you guys want to hear about? Any votes?
I vote for wherever the most struggle was.
The most struggle?
You didn't know where things were going to end up, and then you figured it out.
Okay. Yeah, that's always fun.
I vote for, I've heard your story before, but maybe just to get us all on the same page, the story again, maybe a quick version of it, and always love to hear a founder story. So I would like hearing yours again anyway.
Cool. Yeah, I see a couple familiar faces in here. I can do both of those at the same time because the story really begins like probably like from coming up with the idea for Indie Hackers to launching it, that was 3 weeks. But like, that's not really the story. Like the story is many years of struggle before that. So I can talk about struggle and talk about the beginning of the story. I always wanted to be like a startup founder from the time I was a kid. Like my role model was Bill Gates when I was like 9 years old. And it's because I was, it's funny thinking back, it's because it was the 90s, it was the dot-com boom. I had no idea what the dot-com boom was. I just knew that I liked computers, but every adult around me was super encouraging because I would be on the computer all the time. And so they knew about the dot-com boom and they knew about like Bill Gates and whatever. And they were like, oh, you're the next Bill Gates. Like, you're so good at computers. Like, keep it up. You've got a career ahead of you. But I was just like 8 or 9 years old. I was like, oh, everyone tells me I should do this thing. And I should really do this thing. And so Bill Gates became my role model. And I wanted to like go to a good school and drop out and start a startup. Like, that was kind of my plan for life. So I ended up just learning a lot about computers. But I was never more than like a dabbler. I spent a lot of time. I was like basically a web designer. And like middle school and high school, just making like HTML and CSS websites, doing a little bit of code stuff, dreaming of making video games, mostly just playing video games. And then I went to college and I met a buddy of mine who one day just challenged me to make a Facebook app. He's like, hey, Facebook just released their new platform. We should build an app. And I was like, well, how do you do that? I don't know how to build an app. I really just dabbled with like HTML and CSS and I'm like taking coding classes, but like I'm not that good yet. And he's like, oh, you're dumb. Just like read this guide. And in the course of like 6 months, like I basically taught myself how to code with my friend helping out. I learned PHP. I learned about databases and MySQL. I learned about Ajax and like all these new JavaScript technologies and built like the world's shittiest Facebook app. It was like total garbage. It barely even worked, but it was so fun just like building it and learning that way and realizing that like I had essentially all the skills at that point to build any sort of app from scratch. And once I had sort of a clearer picture of like what I could do, because before that, I think I was always kind of, you know, if I wanted to ever start something, I would need a whole team of people. But after that, I was like, I can kind of do the design. I can kind of do the backend programming and kind of do the front end programming, like a whole team. I don't really need anyone. And I started reading about startups because I was like, well, I could start a startup now. I have all the skills required. I started reading a ton about Paul Graham. I started reading all of his essays about Y Combinator. This was like 2008. Back then, if you wanted to start something like, pretty much this is the only information online about how to get started. Paul Graham writing his essays, as I'm sure many of you have written. And a lot of the wisdom that he gave in those essays is still relevant today. So I applied to Y Combinator. I got rejected like 3 or 4 times. Eventually I got in. with an idea straight from Paul Graham's list, which was all about email. So he was very big on this concept that if you want to start a company, what you do is you start small. And you start with something that seems innocuous that people won't really suspect is going to be big, but you wedge yourself in somewhere that's crucial and then you expand. So the analogy he always gives is Microsoft started as an interpreter for the basic Altair. And everyone's like, what is that? Super technical, who cares about that? And eventually they used that position to sort of like land this amazing deal with IBM where they would provide all the software, like the rest is history. He always thought that email was kind of a bridge. He's like, everybody uses email. Email is so huge, right? If we could build some sort of email application and grow to like all the users of email, you could then get them off of that and onto your own app. And you can build like a huge startup. So this is like very pie in the sky, unicorn, build a billion-dollar startup vision. Who cares about how you make money? Just get as many people as possible. So I met a guy in Hacker News. We both liked email and we applied to YC. We got in finally after my like third or fourth try. And we got to work. So we built this app called Fmail, or not Fmail, it's called Task Force. So Task Force is like my first like legitimate shot at a startup. I had a couple of like failed attempts, but this one I was super excited about. We had a little bit of funding from YC. They gave us like $13,000. So we're like, okay, we can live on this if we scrounge in San Francisco. And it was just like a little widget that sat in your email. You could turn emails into tasks. So if I sent you an email, you could say, oh, Cortland sent me this email, let me turn it into a task. That's my task list. Then I would get a response email that would say, oh, hey, Anthony turned your email into a task, Cortland. And when you checked off that task, it would say, hey, Anthony completed your task. So it's meant to be viral. And it kind of was. Like we got several hundred thousand users after we launched, and it was kind of cool, but it wasn't like rocket ship growth. And we talked to everybody in YC, they're like, oh, you need to go back to the drawing board, try this, try that. And it was all like, how do you get to millions and millions and millions of users and then do something cool with it? Eventually we got pretty frustrated because we weren't getting to millions and millions of users. And it felt pretty bad to be writing this app that lots of people liked, that had hundreds of thousands of people using it and feel like it was a failure. And luckily, this is like the summer of 2011, the Stripe beta came out. So I think it was like July 2011, we were considering quitting and Stripe's beta came out. And we were like, hey, why don't we just try charging for this? And everybody said we were stupid. They're like, you're making a Chrome extension that's a little widget that's like pretty buggy. Why would anyone ever pay you for this? And we're like, well, let's charge like $5 a month. So we just like send an email to everybody, use the app. Hey, we're charging $5 a month if you want these pro features. So like a month making some features pro. And we made something like $3,000, $2,000 our very first weekend. Like instantaneously, a few hundred people signed up. And immediately we were like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like we could grow this. So we went to talk to the people at Y Combinator and they were just all like, nah, this isn't anything. $2,000, like what are you doing? This doesn't make any sense. Like you need to go big. And so this begins the period of my many years of struggle where I was trying to reconcile being an indie hacker and being someone who wanted to just build an app that made money with like being in San Francisco around all these investors who like, you need to go big and anything that makes money basically can't go big. Because the only examples of great startups at that time was like Airbnb, like not even Airbnb, to be honest, it was like Twitter and Facebook. Like Airbnb makes a lot of money, but they came kind of later. Same with Uber, Stripe, Instacart, all the big unicorn startups now that like actually make money. Like back in the day, that wasn't fashionable. So we tried all sorts of things. We like ditched this app that was working. We're like, oh, it's too trivial. We'll never make billions of dollars. We need to make like some sort of bigger productivity suite. And so we spent like a year coding that. Didn't work at all. Basically made the same amount of money. And investors told us the same thing. I eventually quit working with my startup co-founder, went on my own path and started doing more indie hacker type things. But I kind of fell into these traps that like you hear people talking about on the podcast that I talk about on the forum. The big one for me was that as a developer, it just took me way too long to build stuff. I would build things and polish it for like 9 months at a time. And I built all sorts of different apps. So I went back to the drawing board and I resurrected this email app that I'd been building. I built this like sort of clone of Mint that was meant so you could like categorize transactions instantaneously. You get push notifications on your phone and keep your finances organized. I did all sorts of different things. And I never really found success. And eventually after like 6 or 7 years playing the startup game, being pretty upset with myself for like having worked on so many things that didn't really succeed, like having gone into Y Combinator, but not really having anything to show for it, I just quit. I just became like a contractor and started working for other people because I just felt bad. I was like, I don't have very much money in my bank account. SF is getting continually more expensive. If I had just gotten a job at Google or something, a long time ago, like I would be doing way better, right? And I would at least be able to save face and be like, oh, the only reason my startups haven't worked out is because I never tried, you know? But it's like, I've actually tried for a long time and I like want to keep trying and having a good time, but like, what happens if this extends for like 10 years, another 20 years? You know, what if I keep building things and it doesn't work? I didn't really see any sort of light at the end of the tunnel. And so I just took some time off and I just contracted. And contracting is like super lucrative, especially if you're kind of a jack of all trades developer, because the jobs I took were jobs where people were like, hey, we need a designer and a front end programmer and a back end programmer. And I'm like, hey, I'll be all three, but you need to pay me at least like twice as much. And they're like, okay, we'll try it. And then I would just like work crazy hours and get paid a lot. So like after a year or so, I'd saved up like $100,000 basically. And I was like, well, I'm feeling re-energized. I've been working for other people, which is like not what I really want to do. I had a lot of freedom and energy because like I was a contractor. I was more like a consultant. I wasn't like an employee. And so I felt like I was hiring my clients, not that they were hiring me, but still it was too much. I didn't really work for didn't really want to work for anybody else. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board and quit all my contract jobs and said, okay, I'm going to spend a year. I've got a year of runway in San Francisco with these savings. I'm going to try to build something, but I'm going to completely disavow the high growth startup path. I'm going to be 100% based on being an indie hacker. And I was kind of inspired and emboldened because 6 years earlier when I tried that, no one was doing it. But this is like now 2016, and it seemed like it was kind of a common thing. Like people were trying to do this. There are tons of posts on Hacker News about people starting their businesses and sharing how much money they're making. And I was like, if I can make like $5,000 a month, like that's enough to pay for my rent, my food, insurance, et cetera, then I can figure out whatever I want to do with my life. I can just like get to that milestone and I'll be fine. That was my goal for this year, to blow through my savings and just try to get there. And so I spent the first 6 months doing nothing. I spent the first 6 months coding like the world's crappiest apps that I never marketed, that I never launched. And I kind of saw myself falling into the same pattern where I'm like, oh, just like, you know, one more feature and then I think I'll be happy. I built like this task management application. And I was like, so like, I don't know, like I felt like it was so inadequate. So I was like, it's not as good as Asana, so nobody's ever going to use it. So I need to add this feature and that feature and this feature and that feature. I got to rewrite the entire code base because it's so bad. Like I need to redo it. And then at some point, I read a story. I can't remember exactly who it was, but I saw someone who started something. And in the span of like a month, they had already gotten to the point where they were making a few thousand dollars in revenue. And I was like, all right, I should quit. I've been working on this app for so long. The fact of the matter is like, how do you decide? It's like, is my idea wrong? Is my approach wrong? Or is it just I haven't put in the right amount of time? But seeing somebody else who started something and way less time than I did just blew right by me, convinced me that like my idea was a bad one. And I needed to go back to the drawing board and actually from the get-go be a little bit more mindful about my approach. And so I scrapped everything I'd been working on, which is pretty hard to do because I invested a lot of time and a lot of code into working on this thing that like maybe could have worked. And I just sat down and like wrote for the first time a validation checklist. Like, I don't want to just jump into the first idea that excites me. What idea actually has legs? Like, what have I learned from like the last, you know, many years about what works and what doesn't work? And most of it was just stuff about me. Like, I don't do well with projects that require a lot of coding. I get sucked into the black hole of code and it takes forever. So I should only allow myself to work on an idea that's like minimally code intensive. I also don't like working on ideas that are like super, I don't know, esoteric that people don't understand. It's like de-energizing when I tell my friends that I'm working on and their eyes cross and they have no idea what I'm saying. So I want to work on something that's like pretty interesting. I want to work on something that doesn't need millions of users or any funding whatsoever, right? It needs to be able to be profitable within, you know, a few months of work period. It needs to be super quick. So I had this checklist of like, maybe it was like 9 or 10 things. And I was like, all right, now that I have this checklist of constraints, I have to come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. And I spent a few days just like scouring Hacker News, basically, trying to figure out basically what idea I should work on by reading stories that other people had read. So essentially, I would go to this, basically a thread in Hacker News, and I would read a ton of responses. And all these threads, you could still find them. They would just be people asking questions like, what's your one person SaaS startup? Or what's your profitable, you know, business? And like all sorts of developers would chime in and say, oh, I built like a calendaring app and it makes me $100 a month or blah, blah, blah. And I would just like read all these stories looking for patterns and thinking, okay, if I discern enough like patterns by reading these ideas, I'll sort of like become better at generating ideas myself. And I'll figure out some way to like combine these ideas or mix and match them or do something that sort of hits all the items on my validation checklist. And so that was also kind of frustrating because if you're doing nothing but reading other people's ideas, like it was a full-time job for me. I didn't have a job. It was like wake up, read ideas, jot ideas down, go to bed, like 12 hours a day, just doing nothing but that. And so like after a few hours of doing that, you get pretty frustrated. after like 2 days of like all my ideas suck, I was like, I guess I'm never going to come up with a good idea. Then the third day, I had kind of a few breakthroughs where I came up with a few ideas where I was like, this idea actually has legs. And I was definitely like brute forcing it, which is going against the advice to like, you know, let inspiration strike. I was like sitting down from the ground up trying to craft ideas and like forcing this thing to happen. And so I started doubting whether or not that could actually work. But it did work, fortunately for me. I came up with a few ideas that I thought would possibly be good. And Indie Hackers, pretty much in its current form, was one of those ideas. And so sort of breakdown of how that happened is that I was reading about Peter Levels creating Nomad List. He was like always in these different posts. And he would always share his story. And it was a very simple story that had like, I don't know, carried a lot of weight with people. People liked it. They always voted him to the top. And it was, hey, you know, I wanted to be a digital nomad, but it was really hard to travel. I put up a spreadsheet on Hacker News where people could come and add in different locations and different features of those locations to basically try to figure out where should digital nomads travel at what time of year. Everyone did it. It kind of caught fire. It was really huge. I realized that this idea had legs. So I turned the spreadsheet into a website and was kind of a list. Then I made the website even better. People started subscribing to my newsletter where I would update the website. And from there, I got those people onto an internet forum where they were sort of like captured, because if it's just a list, people come back like once every year or two. But if it's like a community where people can talk to each other, then people will come back to talk to each other every day. And so that's how the traffic kind of grew. And then I use that traffic to find advertisers, and that's how I make my money. And I was like, I like that game plan. That makes a lot of sense. Can I take that game plan and sort of, you know, adapt it to some other type of business idea that's not digital nomad communities? So that was one half of the idea. And the other half of the idea was just very meta, looking at what I was doing. I was like, oh, what problems do people have? Like, what are people's challenges? What are your own problems? And I couldn't figure out any problems in my life. And then I realized, like, obviously the problem is like, I don't have a business idea. And obviously the solution for me is like reading a bunch of other people's case studies. And obviously I'm not alone in doing this. Look at all these other people who are also in the comments doing the same thing that I'm doing, asking all these questions. And so the problem that I should solve, something that I'm passionate about and something that checked off most of the things in my validation checklist, was like helping people come up with business ideas, which is something that I also knew about because like I was my own customer, so to speak. And so I combined these things and I was like, what would it look like if I combine these two ideas? If I'm trying to solve the problem of helping people basically do the same kind of research that I'm doing, but also using the sort of like gradually start small but get bigger process that Peter Levels used for Nomad List. And I drew up kind of the plan for Indie Hackers. Like, I'll start with really helpful content. It'll be basically the same content you see on Hacker News, but I'll make it better. Right? These are just random people making comments on a forum. Most of them aren't sharing their revenue numbers, they're not sharing tactics, they're not sharing strategies. And I could read in the comments and see exactly what people wanted. Like, people would complain. They would say, hey, what's your revenue number? Or hey, how did you do X? And so I'm like, okay, I know exactly what my content needs to look like based on what people are asking for. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with Sales Safari. This is Amy Hoy's sort of validation technique for how you can validate your startup idea. And the whole insight behind it is, instead of talking to people and asking them, hey, what are your problems? That's fraught with risk. People, generally speaking, don't know what their problems are. They don't know what good business ideas are. They're not going to be able to tell you if your business idea is good. If they could do that with any reliability, they would be like super rich investors. And so talking to people is very, I don't want to say like bad, but it's like unreliable unless you ask the right questions. So there's books about that, like the Mom Test. But Amy Hoy's approach is like, don't talk to people. Like, try to find the truth. Go look at what people are talking about on internet forums. Go observe other people talking to each other. She calls it Sales Safari because it's kind of like the analog is going on a safari and like watching the animals gather at their watering holes, right? You want to watch them in their natural environment. You don't want to like fuck with them, or like go to the zoo and like put them in an unnatural environment and probe them and stuff, because you're not going to get like a real interaction. And so I was sort of unwittingly doing that by looking at what people were saying on the forum. It was like the truth of what they actually wanted and what information they actually cared about, rather than me like talking to them and trying to construct truth artificially. So anyway, I decided the only way I could possibly get the content that checked all the boxes that these people wanted was if I did interviews. If I just invited people to write stuff, they would write all sorts of stuff like they're doing on the forum. But if I asked interview questions, then I could sort of guide people down a path and make sure they answer the right questions. So my plan was basically this, as I envisioned it: get a bunch of interviews on the website, launch those interviews on Hacker News, where I know people will like them because people on Hacker News already like this stuff. So why wouldn't they like my website, which is just a better version of what they've already done? Use that traffic to build up a mailing list. Use that mailing list as sort of repeat traffic. So when I do more interviews, I could basically send them out to the mailing list and get more traffic. Use that traffic to basically, number one, attract advertisers, and number two, build some sort of community forum. Because the mailing list might not be enough. People might get bored of it. They might unsubscribe. But if I build a community forum, then people can talk to each other. And then that's user-generated content. And I'm not having to make posts or interviews, like people are actually helping each other out. And it's like the most scalable thing that I could do. So that was like my like plan, which is directly ripped off from Nomadless plan. It was like to a T, the exact same plan that Peter Levels had followed. And it worked out almost exactly that way. So like the first few days was just like me coming up with a name for Indie Hackers. I put a lot of thought into that. I wanted it to be something that was memorable and also something that described the group as a whole, rather than I just read a whole book on branding, you know, like how should you come up with the name? I was like, I'm only going to make this decision once. I might as well put a day of thought into it. I spent some time coming up with the design. This is also part of the branding. I was like, I want the site to be something that stands out. There's so many other people who create these sites for entrepreneurs, but they all look the same. They're all like white. They all look the same. Like, I'm just going to make my website dark blue for literally the sole reason that when people come to visit it, I want them to remember it. If you come to Indie Hackers twice, they'll be like, oh, I've been here before. Whereas if you go to someone's post on Medium, you don't even know who the author is because it looks like every other Medium post. So I had a bunch of stuff like that in the first 2 days of just like planning strategically, like what have I learned in the past 7 years and how can I bring that to bear on this idea? And then after that, it was like coding the website, which hilariously took me like 3 weeks to do. And it's a blog. Like people, like there's already blogging software. Like I could have just used WordPress or anything else, but it was kind of a testament to the fact that like, I was right. I really suck at like controlling myself as a developer and I will spend way too much time coding. And so it was good for me to pick this idea that was essentially a very non-code intensive idea. Otherwise I could have spent a year doing it if I spent 3 weeks doing just a blog. And mostly just sending emails. Probably like half of every day was me sending emails to people who had shared their stories in Hacker News and asking them for more details. Like, hey, loved your story in that comment. Thought it was really cool how you did this. I'm starting a site to inspire more people to do the same thing that you did. Would you mind doing an interview with me, et cetera? Every email I sent was handcrafted. Another thing that I learned, like people don't like spam. Happens on the Indie Hackers forum all the time too. Like everyone kind of learns this lesson when they first start. Like you can't spam people. And so if you don't handcraft and hand tailor your emails, then people will just like spam you or mark you as spam and your emails won't go to anybody. So it took a ridiculous amount of time and my success rate was still pretty low. But like a lot of people responded. A lot of people were like, that's a really cool idea. I like the sound of it. But I don't want to share my revenue numbers, or I'll get back to you next year when my business is in a better situation. So that was a huge slog. I sent like 140, 150 emails, and I only got like 3 weeks later, I had completed 10 interviews. So it felt like the vast majority of that was just me wasting my time. And I was like, I don't know if I would even want to run this business if it continues going this way, even if it works out, because I just don't like sending this many cold emails. It's ridiculous. The cool thing was that by the time I had those 10 interviews up on the website, I had a kind of an audience where it was this audience of other people who were like me, who are indie hackers, who knew what I was doing and were like pretty supportive, even if they didn't do their own interview. And so before I launched, I was like, hey, everybody take a look at the website. Let me know what you think. And a lot of people were like, oh, this is cool. Oh, you know what? I said I didn't have time for an interview. Like I want to be part of this. And so then I got even more interviews. But then when I launched on Hacker News, I emailed everybody as well and said like, hey, I'm going to launch tomorrow. Thank you so much for your help. And like, that's all I said. And so then the launch happened. And almost everybody who had an interview on the site upvoted it. And so it hit the front page like super fast. Like I told them I was going to launch it. I posted it and like hit the front page in like 5 or 10 minutes. But that was only like maybe like 9 or 10 upvotes. But after that, like it just caught fire. People on Hacker News loved it. It was like number one or number two in Hacker News for like a full 24 hours. I got like 50,000 page views in like the first day and like another 50,000 page views the second day. The mailing list grew to like 1,000 people in that first week. Someone put it on Product Hunt. It got number one product of the week on Product Hunt. And it was like this huge thing where I was like, all right, finally, after many years of working on something and like not really succeeding, like seems like my plan is working. And like phase one is complete. Like I've got the traffic. I've like sort of validated that like phase one works. I've got the mailing list. That's working. So now I just have to make sure that I can do more interviews and get more traffic. And so the next 6 weeks was like me just doing more and more interviews, which were now way easier because people were actually sending me interview requests. Like, oh, this is cool. Can you interview me? So I wasn't even prospecting anymore. And then just sending out emails to my mailing list. And half of my emails in those early days would be like me sharing my story. Here's what I'm working on. Here's why I'm doing it. Here's what's next. And then the other half would be like, here's 5 new interviews that I did this week. It was crazy. I was doing like 5 or 6 interviews a week back then. So I was doing nothing but interviewing and emailing people. And I'd watch my traffic. And it was pretty depressing actually, because the traffic was just going down. Because like, if you come off of a high of like a huge launch, like there's no way your traffic's gonna go up from that. Like, how could it possibly go up? But it still doesn't feel like a good thing. It feels like shit because you're like, oh man, I'm putting in so much work to this website and it's getting less and less popular every single week. So like for 6 weeks, I'm pretty sure every single week had less traffic than the week before. And I was like every week hoping that I would like hit some sort of a baseline where it would bottom out and stay that way because I had my email list. And it was sort of anxious about this because I knew I needed traffic to attract advertisers. Like, this idea wasn't going to work if I didn't have enough traffic for people to pay for advertising. So I landed my first sponsor probably a couple weeks after launching, just someone who was a fan who didn't even care about the revenue. He was just like, here's $800. I love your site. Put my company on your homepage for a little bit. So I did that. But after that, I was like not confident that I could really sell to sponsors. And I was just more obsessed with building traffic. So I tried everything. What ended up working is like super obvious in hindsight, which is that the place that first gave IndieHacker traffic, Hacker News, also would allow me to get more traffic in the future. So I think one of my interviewees submitted their interview to Hacker News and it blew up. And I was like, oh, I should just submit all the interviews to Hacker News. And if they're good, then they'll blow up. And if they're not, they're not. And so that's what I did like the first 4 months. And reliably, like every other interview I submitted, went at the front page. Eventually the moderators at Hacker News told me that I had to stop submitting so many times because they didn't want the site to just be anti-hackers. And so they limit me to like one post per month. And that sticks today. Like even today, basically IndieHackers is like an automatic penalty on it on Hacker News. And then if I want to submit my one post a month, I will email the Hacker News moderators and say, hey, this is my post. And then they will release the penalty for that one post. And if it does well, it does well without getting penalized. If it doesn't, then I get, you know, that was my shot. So yeah, it worked out really well. Eventually the traffic was like good enough where I felt like I could attract advertisers in December of that year. So I launched in August. About 4 months later in December, I started really in earnest trying to attract advertisers and sponsors because I was running out of money. So I put up a sponsorship page on the website. I started emailing people who I knew had companies and asking if they would sponsor. I would put blurbs in the newsletter like, this is an empty spot, your ad could go here. And I started getting lots of indie hackers who would say, oh yeah, I want to try to grow my business. Let me advertise because that's who I was talking to. And it turned out like indie hackers were the worst customers for me because like none of us make very much money or have very much money. And so like people really were super worried about how their ads were going to perform. Like I would sell somebody an ad slot for $200 and they would email me every single day asking how many clicks they got, can we tweak the ad, et cetera, et cetera. And it got to the point where advertising was taking up like half of my time every week. Like I wasn't even able to do new interviews. I wasn't able to make the forum better. I wasn't able to really get the podcast off the ground because I spent so much time on ads. I ended up talking to someone else I knew who had like a successful advertising run business. He was like, no, you're doing it all wrong. Like you have to go up market. Like you need to be emailing companies like Stripe, right? You need to be emailing like TopTal, like companies that have like a ton of venture funding with more money than they know what to do with. And they're trying new ways to grow and contact them and get them to advertise. And I was like, well, that's never going to work. Because like, who am I, right? They don't know who I am. I don't know how to do sales. But at the same time, like having done all these interviews for indie hackers, I kind of recognized that there's truth there. Cause like the people I was interviewing, like they seemed to succeed when they did the same thing and targeted bigger customers, charged more money and focused on sales. So I started doing that and it worked beautifully. I would just send cold emails to people like, hey, you know, so-and-so at MailChimp, I'm on the site called Indie Hackers. Here's why it would be great for you guys. Let me know if you're interested. I'd love to share more. And I kept them all short, like 3 or 4 sentences. And way more I wanted to say, but like people don't read emails if you send them a long giant email. And it turned out that most of these people were happy to talk to me. It was pretty much their job description to buy ads for their companies because they were all like in the marketing department. And so I ended up landing ad deals that were just like $1,000 for 2 weeks, you know, $3,000 for a month of email newsletter ads. And it got like significantly easier and was way better. And I think my revenue in December was something like $1,000. In January, it was like $2,000. In February, it was like $4,000. And in March, it was like on track to be like $8,000 or $9,000. So it was like consistently doubling. And I finally had like hit the promised land. That was also the point where Patrick Collison from Stripe emailed me and basically said that he wanted to acquire Indie Hackers. So that was just like a random email out of the blue that I wasn't on my radar at all. And the subject line was literally acquire Indie Hackers. And he was like, hey, would you ever be open to this? And so for pretty much all of March, I just talked to him about basically what it would look like if Indie Hackers became part of Stripe. And we worked through that deal. It's a lot of negotiation, a lot of lawyers, a lot of paperwork, but it was relatively painless compared to what I thought it might be. And at the end of March, first week of April, I like officially got a desk at Stripe and we announced that Indie Hackers is now part of Stripe. We shut down all the ads and that was 2.5 years ago. So Indie Hackers has now been part of Stripe for much longer than it was ever independent. It was only independent for like 9 or 10 months. And things have been great. Like I run the site doing cool stuff like this, working with people like Anthony, who's run all sorts of cool meetups. And we're still doing interviews. The forum has gotten a lot bigger, a lot livelier. We got a lot of new cool features like groups and milestones and more stuff planned for the future. we're doing something like 60 meetups every month, and that number has been growing. And really the vision for the site at this point is just to make it like the biggest, most lively community of founders like yourselves helping each other out. So like my charter at Stripe is just like, how do you make your website better? Like what can you do to make it like easier for people to use, to make it better, to make it more impactful, more influential, and also how do you make it bigger? So there's like no revenue involved. Like, ironically, it's like I've kind of become a high growth startup again, rather than being an indie hacker business. But it's not so bad because at least I don't have investors. You know, it's just sort of owned. So anyway, that's my story. That's how I got to where I am. Obviously, I skipped over a lot of stuff. Obviously, a lot of you have probably heard a lot of parts of that before. That's all I got.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing, Cortland. Definitely identifying hard with a lot of points in that story. For questions, guys, you can either ask them out loud or you can post them in the chat, either privately or to the group, and either Cortland will see them or I'll ask them. And so I'll start off with one I got from Karthik. He wants to ask that he's trying to validate an idea, but finding it hard to reach customers over email and phone, thinking about visiting them in person, but that's not super scalable. The market is small business owners in a niche segment, and he wants to know if you have any tips.
Small business owners in a niche segment. Well, it depends entirely on the niche. I think that in and of itself is an important realization. Every niche has its own different marketing channels that work well for it. Essentially, if you do something that doesn't work well for your niche or works well for some other niche, it doesn't really matter, right? So if you're, you know, like I tried to start a business once when I was in college that was basically a competitor to Craigslist. And I would need to get a bunch of brokers to list their apartments on my website. Brokers are pretty old fashioned. They don't really browse the internet. They're not on Hacker News. They don't do a lot of Google searches. Like what I ended up doing was walking around Boston on foot, talking to brokers by knocking on their door and going to their offices where they were super comfortable, and then bringing out my laptop and showing them. And so like, I don't think that's actually always a bad idea. It really depends on your niche. Patrick McKenzie, sometimes better known as Patio 11, did the same thing. He had a business called Appointment Reminder. He needed to basically sell this to people who made appointments, professionals. So that was doctors, lawyers, dentists, also an old fashioned group of people. He tried lots of things. The thing that worked best was him literally going door to door and talking to them and showing them what he was working on. So yeah, I wouldn't count that out, but it really depends on your niche. Like if you're dealing with software engineers, like software engineers are super tech savvy. We don't necessarily have offices that you can knock on our doors. If we're your niche, then your niche, like you should probably be targeting us on like SEO because we do a lot of Google searches because we're very familiar with that kind of stuff. If you're targeting small business owners, it really depends like what kind of small business owners they are. But like, I would try to figure out like where they congregate, like where do those small business owners go to talk to each other? And like, how do they basically find out about new things? They're probably using some sort of tools or businesses or websites or something that's common between them. Like, how do they adopt those things? And so if I were you, I would just do some learning. If you're having trouble growing, it probably just means you don't understand the distribution channels that your target market favors. So just like talk to them however you can. Just talk to a few of them and ask them like, hey, what are you using for your business? What do you pay for? How did you hear about that? Where did that come from? Right. And they'll all tell you stories. You don't get to see sort of patterns, but oh, here's how I heard about it. You know, and it might be something like word of mouth. You know, every year at the so-and-so convention, we all get together and then that's where we talk to each other about what's going on. Right. Or it might be some other mechanism. Maybe they all listen to this particular radio show or this type of podcast, or they read this type of book. You know, maybe they only get their information from the Journal of Medical Science, and that's how they decide what they're going to use. So I think it depends entirely on your niche. And the best way to figure that out is by talking to people. The thing that I think most early founders do wrong is they're afraid of sales, because most of us are software engineers and we don't like talking to people. We just want to build something and have it just show up. But if you do the sales, like you're actually trying to sell people and stuff early on, even if that's not a viable way for you to grow your business in the long term, it's really good upfront because it's educational and you'll learn all sorts of stuff. And so it really just comes down to asking the right questions and making sure you talk to people. But if you're doing the sales and talking to people, even if it's in person, which is super inefficient at first, you'll learn like a ridiculous amount because like you say things and people respond, right? And then you get to respond to their response. You get to ask questions. They can ask you questions. If you just put up a website and people don't like it, you have no idea why, right? They just click away and you see that they bounced, but you have no idea like how to make things better. You're just guessing. And so it's going to take you like way more iterations of guessing to hit on something that's true if you have that approach than it is if you're doing something like I was doing, like going door to door or calling people up, emailing them, etc. But it's a slog. So it's like, it's not going to be like overnight you're just like a super success. Like, you're going to have to send a ton of emails. Like, I had to send 150 emails for Indie Hacker just to get the first 10 interviews, but just like grin and bear it. I know so many stories of people who had to do that. Like Jason Grishkoff, the very first person I had on the podcast, he started a site where it's like for people submitting music. And he already had kind of a distribution channel, right? He had like a blog for indie music owners, and he had tens of thousands of visits a month, and people were already like basically trying to ask him to feature their music. So when he built this other thing where he was like trying to, you know, encourage music submissions, you would think, oh, this is how I grow. But like, no, that didn't work. He had to send 1,000 handcrafted personal emails. He was sending like hundreds of emails a week for multiple months, and it was grueling work for him to get his business off the ground, just to get like the flywheel started, just to get the first customers in the door so he could like prove that things were working, and then it came easier. So I'd say don't skip that step. Don't get discouraged if it feels like it's taking a long time. It just takes a long time sometimes to get people to try something that's new. But make sure you're talking to them in like a high fidelity way where you're getting feedback, and you'll learn a lot, and keep pushing, and you'll probably get somewhere. Either that, or you'll figure out that your product is like crappy, right? You'll figure out one of those two things. But that's better than nothing.
You guys mind if I jump in?
Yeah, go for it.
Corlin, you mentioned, first of all, thank you for coming on. This is really insightful. Second of all, you mentioned that book that you read about asking the correct questions in terms of validating your ideas. And you also mentioned Safari in that. What was that called?
Okay, so yeah, the Safari thing is called Sales Safari. It's a technique pioneered by a woman named Amy Hoy, A-M-Y-H-O-Y. She started a company called Freckle. She's one of like the original bootstrappers. She started this like 10 or 15 years ago. Makes 8 figures a year, I think, or at least 7. It's like a time tracking software. But she sort of pivoted from that. I mean, it still exists, but she decided to start teaching bootstrappers. So she teaches a class called 30 by 500, where you like essentially go into that class and she like helps you think about how to come up with an idea, how to start an online business. It's really good. Like, I've never taken the class, but a lot of good people have come out of it. I've had like 3 or 4 people on the podcast who came up with their business idea while they were in her program and then graduated. And like now their business is like killing it. Like Joel Hooks from Egghead.io is a good example of someone who went through 30 by 500. Brennan Dunn, another person, he started Right Message, and he started a couple other businesses that have all done millions in revenue. So that's Sales Safari. Sales Safari is her whole technique. The one about asking questions and talking to customers is called the Mom Test. It's written by Rob Fitzpatrick. He's on the Indie Hackers Forum all the time. I think he's at Rob Fitz. It's a book he wrote like 7 or 8 years ago, and it didn't really catch on. But now it's been like slowly gaining in popularity as like the Indie Hackers movement sort of grows, and other people like figure out like it just becomes more common that like more regular people need to talk to customers to try to learn things. And the entire premise of that book is that like people lie. Like the opening chapter is a conversation where it's like a typical startup founder has an idea and he's talking to his mom and asking her all these questions like, hey, would you use this? Or don't you think this is a great idea, et cetera? And like people just lie to make you feel better. And he has like a set of questions, and it's really a set of principles that you should stick to prevent yourself from basically being inadvertently lied to. So the questions that prioritize like asking for things that are true. Like you don't ask someone, would you use something like this? You ask someone who's like, when was the last time you bought a cookbook? Right? It's hard to lie about that question. They don't even think about lying. They're just like, oh yeah, it's been 10 years, right? You're getting actual concrete information. So these are sort of two different approaches, Sales Safari, talking to customers. Both of them are helpful. They're not mutually exclusive. You can do both. But like there's wrong ways and right ways to do both of them.
Awesome, Corlin. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.
And so I had a question specifically about the podcast. I think you like clearly do a lot of research into each of those episodes. And so I'm interested, like, as you're kind of going through the process of interviewing people, how much do you try to kind of like create an overarching like story or like an arc versus just kind of like trying to ask the most interesting questions?
Yeah, it's a combination. And to be honest, like I don't have it figured out. Early on, I thought a lot about creating an overarching story. And then I had a couple of interviews where it was just like, I realize that it's just hard to do in a conversation because you don't know how the other person's going to respond. And so you might ask a question thinking it's going to be a first in a series of 10 questions about a person's story, and they'll just like give you their entire story and then you're out of questions. You might want the interview to go in a certain way, but they might be in a certain mood where they don't really want to talk about something, right? There's been times where I've heard someone tell a really amazing story about how they came up with their idea. And then I ask them how they came up with their idea and they don't tell that story, or they tell like a different story. And I think as time has gone on, I've just sort of learned to give up control. Like, you're not going to be able to necessarily control exactly what someone says. You can't necessarily plan out exactly the kind of story they're going to tell unless you plan it with them in advance. It just sounds unnatural, and it's not how at least my podcast works. The alternative approach is, I guess you could have a super heavily edited podcast, interview somebody. Like, I met a guy who interviewed, it took him 3 months to put out a 30-minute podcast episode. And this is his entire show. And the show has like millions of listeners. It's a big show. But they will literally interview dozens and dozens and dozens of people for hours each, sit them all together and create a narrative. If you're doing that, you can create a narrative. I think for the most part nowadays, I kind of think of an episode as themes. So it's like, okay, what's interesting about this person? There might be three or four broad themes that I think are unique to their personality or unique to their story or that people should learn about. And let me come up with questions around those themes. So it kind of seems like the questions are connected and not just like random scattershot questions. They're all sort of getting it kind of the same thing. Like, this person is really curious, or this person's like really never gives up and keeps persisting, or this person is really into exploring lots of different ideas. And my questions will be oriented around those themes. And then I generally try to go chronologically. So my thinking for an episode is like, the beginning of an episode should be really interesting. So I should just try to ask like the most interesting question and get them talking about something that people will be fascinated by. But then beyond that, like, a narrative is just captivating. Like, something about hearing a series of events related in chronological order that just appeals to like the human brain for whatever reason. So like, I'll try to go back to the beginning of their story, which I don't think you really care about at first, unless you've heard something interesting that they've done. That's why I don't start there. But after doing something interesting, we'll go to the beginning of their story and sort of ask them how they got started. And then naturally they'll end up kind of telling the story and my questions will kind of flow and hopefully we'll get somewhere. But it's not super strict. Like, I've never been able to successfully have like a very detailed plan for how an episode goes and it go that exact way.
And then, have you kind of done anything specific around growth of the podcast, or that has kind of just like come through the overall Indie Hackers platform?
Yeah, it's like, I started the podcast 4 months after the podcast came out in February of 2017. Indie Hackers was August of 2016. So it was like 5 months basically after the website launched. By that time, I already had a mailing list. I already had the community going. That was a good kickstart. The early days of the podcast, like, I can probably pull up a graph right now and show you what the podcast growth looks like. The early days, it wasn't getting like a crazy number of downloads, but it is like steadily grown. And I haven't done anything and like anything super specific to try to grow it. Like, I'm not like a strategic podcast growth guy. The best thing that I've done for the podcast is basically just be consistent. Let's see. Tell me if you can see my screen.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is the podcast growth. Every dot here is a different day. The numbers represent the number of unique downloads. You can see the very beginning, I was getting something like 500 or 600 downloads a day, and it just consistently went up. The good thing about podcasts is that people subscribe to them. So unlike like if you like start a blog, by default, no one really has to subscribe to your blog. They might read your post, you might get a lot of traffic, but then they go away and you never see them again, unless you capture them on like an email list or some sort of like, you know, social channel like Twitter where they follow you. Podcasts are generally consumed through podcast players. People subscribe. So if you put out good episodes and people like it enough to subscribe, then they'll get notified of future episodes. And so you're not only reaching new people, but you're kind of bringing along these older people. So you have like pretty good retention as far as content is concerned. Most content on the web is really bad retention. And so you can see it just kind of grows naturally without me doing anything to promote it, just because like the previous subscribers don't really churn. There's some huge dips here where it was like, oh, it's going so high, and then it stopped. Mostly that's like a result of me either not releasing episodes. So we don't see these spikes, is where it was inconsistent. Or there's some places like this where there's like a little gap between these spikes, and that's because there's just like a missed episode. And every time I miss an episode, you can see like this baseline download numbers kind of suffer. Whereas if I'm being consistent, like it happened this year, you can see the baseline download numbers like go up. And that's what matters. Like, the little peaks at the top are misleading. Those fluctuate depending on how popular the guest is, how good that particular episode was, how much I wanted to share on Twitter, et cetera. But like the baseline minimum downloads, even on off days, like watching that grow is what matters. And for me, the only thing that's been good about that has been consistency and I would say quality. Podcasting is an area where it's like you've got a lot of competition. Unless you have some sort of super niche, unique show, there's probably lots of other people who have a similar show to you. And at the end of the day, when you have a lot of competition, you generally don't grow unless you're significantly better than a lot of your competition for whatever reason. Because you probably grow through word of mouth. And people are not going to tell their friend about like the fifth best podcast that they listen to. They're going to tell them about their favorite podcast. And so for me, like, I put a lot of effort into coming up with good questions to try to having good guests. I edit my episodes to make them like flow more smoothly afterwards. A lot of people don't do that. They release a podcast and it's kind of crappy and they're like, oh, that's good enough. And it doesn't grow because no one's recommending it because it's not that good. Even within the Indie Hackers podcast, like, there are some episodes where it's like probably a good third of the episodes, I'm like, that wasn't that great. And then like probably another third, I'm like, that was an amazing episode. And then another third, I'm just like, eh. But like, there's some outlier episodes that are like, I'm like, that was one of the best episodes I've ever done. And the growth numbers for those episodes reflect that. Like, I did an episode with my friend Lynn Tai. We recorded it like sitting right here. She's one of my good friends and has been for 13 years, and people could really tell. And she had a really great story too. She's pretty much unheard of. She doesn't have a big Twitter following. She didn't share it with a ton of people. Her episode has gotten like, I think, the second most number of downloads of any episode of all time. It grew like a rocket ship. It might be first now. And that's just because it was a good episode. So like, podcasts grow through word of mouth. Word of mouth is fueled by quality. The only way to have quality with the podcast is to be a good host and put in the time to prepare really good episodes, in my opinion. And like, that's hard. There's no shortcut besides just like a lot of time put into it. There probably are some growth hacks, but I've talked to a lot of podcasters and we always ask each other this question. And I've never heard a satisfying answer for a good podcast growth hack.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Corlin, I got a question for you. By the way, thank you for doing Indie Hackers. Like, it's an awesome community. I've been just really, really enjoying all the content. So awesome work. You've seen now like so many different businesses, so many different business models. And I'm curious, do you have an opinion on which business models you like? And of course, like this, you know, it depends or whatever, but just for you and kind of for an indie hackerish audience, like, cause you're basically a publisher. I mean, that's kind of your business model. And then you've got marketplaces and e-commerce and SaaS and all these. So not a particular business, but a model that after you've had this incredible 30,000 foot view of all these different ideas, do any patterns emerge of something that really grabs you as appealing as a model?
It depends. No, I won't say it depends. Okay. So, I mean, obviously it does depend. I'm going to tailor my answer to like a prototypical indie hacker. There are certain things that stand out to me. From like a hypothetical perspective, like there are certain constraints that I think should be on most indie hackers' checklists. Like, I don't think you should start a business where you can't charge people a lot of money. If you can't charge people at least $100 or $200 a month, like, I don't think you should start that business as an indie hacker because it's going to be way harder for you. So I could like stick to the hypothetical level, but like the specifics, I really like the business model that indie hackers had. And I've seen others do it in better ways that, like, knowing that, I would have gone back and made some tweaks. I think they did it better than I did it and better than Peter Levels did it. Like, I think the person I just mentioned, Lynn Tai, her business is like the perfect execution of that. And the business model is like, quite frankly, what you do is you take some sort of niche interest or some sort of niche thing that people are, a niche interest that requires research that is like hard, that people are spending lots of time doing. And you do that research for them at a really high quality and you put it all in one place. Where you create the best resource online for a particular thing. Basically, it's content. So Nomadlist, yeah, it's a community, but it's content. Indie Hackers, yeah, it's a community, but it's content. It's stories. Nomadlist is data about businesses. Our website Key Value is data about companies and their cultural values and what it's actually like to work there. So if you're trying to find a job as a software engineer, there's no better place to go at a startup. There's no better place to go than Key Values to find that information. Because she's done that research. She spends like a ridiculous amount of time talking to these companies and putting together really customized detailed profiles for them and doesn't let them get away with like wishy-washy answers, right? So that's step one. Step two is if you do that, you've actually picked a good niche and a good market and there's like distribution channels for it. Like, people in those distribution channels will love you and you will go to the top every time because it's better than anything else out there because you picked a good niche. And at that point in time, you can charge money to advertisers. Now, here's the thing that I got wrong. I won't say I got it wrong, but like, I definitely would do it differently. Like, the way that I was doing it was almost like there's three parties involved. There's me creating the content, there's the indie hackers reading the content, and then the advertisers, and like I'm the bridge, just connecting these two different people. And the problem with that was, and I guess the fourth group was like the people I'm interviewing who are creating the content. So there's like four of us. The problem with that is that the people who are reading are trying to connect to the people who are doing the interviews and providing the useful information. They're not trying to connect to the advertisers. They don't care about the advertisers. So the advertisers are actually like a demerit against the site when they see that advertising revenue, when they see those advertising messages. the way that like Lynn has done it with her site and some others have done it as well, like Ben Tossel's done this with MakerPad, is they sort of combined the advertisers and the content producers into one bucket. So if you go to key values, like she doesn't have a bunch of company profiles and then ads alongside the company profiles. The company profiles are themselves ads. Like companies pay her money to put their profiles on the site. So the thing that the readers are actually coming to read is the ad. They're one and the same. This is good for a number of reasons. Number one, it makes the ads way more effective. People are literally coming there to read the ads. So like they get way more clicks and companies are happier. Number two, it doesn't split your attention as a founder. You're not like creating good content and creating ads. They're one and the same. It's one activity. With Indie Hackers, like every day I spend on ads was a day that I wasn't making the site better. It was in fact a day that I was making the site worse. So you align, you bring your goals into alignment if you combine those two things. And straightforwardly, you just make a lot more money. Like advertising is a very lucrative business because it's very high ARPU. Advertisers pay a lot of money, especially if your advertisers are bigger companies. So Ben Tossel is MakerPad. I think he grew like 30K a month in revenue in like 6 months because he's charging advertisers like $5,000 each to put a profile on his site. So his site is like tutorials. Like how do you, as a person who doesn't know how to code, how do you build an app like Asana, right? Are there tools you can use as a non-coder to build these complex websites and apps? It turns out there are, but there's not that many tutorials. So Ben Tossel is gathering all the information online and creating these tutorials. Lo and behold, the tutorials are basically advertisements for certain companies. So he partners with them to create the tutorials. They pay him $5,000 or $10,000. He pockets that money, puts the ad up. Readers come to his site happy to read this ad. And it's not like some sort of separate ad slapped on top. So that's my all-time favorite Indie Hackers business model.
Cool.
That I think can be replicated across an infinite number of niches and provide like a pretty good lifestyle business for lots of different people.
Awesome. Thank you.
Hey, Coachman. This is Alex. I had a quick question. So if you know you want to be an indie hacker, is YC still valuable? Like what is your experience there?
Yes. So good experience here. I keep bringing her up, Lintai. She went through YC. She started her business, Key Values, went through YC. Yes, YC is valuable. YC is valuable because, quite frankly, like it can never hurt to have a lot of connections to really smart people who are themselves running businesses and can potentially be your customers, because they give you enough money to really help you out as an indie hacker. Like they'll give you $150,000 or something, which is enough that is like a solo founder, or maybe even like a pair of co-founders, you can survive for a couple of years and get your business off the ground. They don't take that much equity, and the energy is just really good. Like you go to YC and you're working in a cohort in the same room as all these other people with all these mentors. Like there's no way you do that and you don't work really hard and you get some good mentorship too. So I think like one of the hardest things to do as an indie hacker is just to not quit. It's really easy to quit. Like things don't go well. You're spending your own money. No one really knows you're working on this. You don't have good mentorship. You don't know if you're doing the right things or the wrong things. Like you quit, right? And that's what kills your business. YC makes it very hard to quit because you have all these things pointing in the same direction that help you out. There are caveats. Number one, if you're like sure that you want to be an indie hacker, YC will test your faith. YC will push you as hard as possible to, at the end of YC, go to demo day and raise money from investors and try to go big and try to go hard. And the advice that all the partners are going to give you is for how you can become a billion-dollar unicorn company. And they're not going to want to hear you talk about how you want to just like get to profitability or anything like that. They're going to want to see you go hard. This is a problem that Lynn had when she was in YC. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's your business. No one can force you to do anything, right? You're an adult. You own it. Just because they put in some money doesn't give them like the ability to tell you what to do. They're not taking a board seat. So you can do whatever you want. Lynn didn't go to demo day. She didn't raise money, but it was hard because like all the meetings she had with the partners, she was constantly having to defend herself and her position. The vast majority of people there are doing it the other way. And it's really easy to sort of get swept up into that peer pressure and like end up raising money. I talked to Austin Allred. He created Lambda School, super popular company. He was an indie hacker, browsing indie hackers for like 6 or 7 months before he created that business. Like that's what he wanted to do. He was like, he'd raised money from investors before and been bitten by that process, didn't like it, started Lambda School, it was going well, then like kind of like got into YC and was still convinced he's not gonna raise money. And like the partners did exactly what I'm telling you. Like they sat down and like, tried to convince him to raise money, badged him about raising money. Eventually they did convince him to raise money and he's raised a ton of money and now he's on that path. I think he's happy about it. Like he's made peace with it, but like that's what's going to happen if you go to YC. That's what basically their incentive is as investors. They need you to be worth a ton of money for them to make a return on their investment. So like don't go into YC without expecting to be badgered about that. And like probably like their success rate is a lot higher than their failure rate of convincing you to go down that path.
Cool. Thank you.
Kefa in the chat asks, you recommend solving personal problems, but what are the downsides if you do decide to tackle an established market that you don't have personal experience in, but you notice a gap you can solve for?
Yeah, this is one of those pieces of advice that, like, I don't know, it can go either way, you know? There's no, like, there are upsides to solving your own problem, right? If you solve your own problem, that means you're going to understand the problem a lot better. And if you understand the problem a lot better, then, like, you can kind of save work. Like, you don't have to talk to as many customers to get an idea. You don't have to, like, browse as many forums, et cetera. There's a huge downside to solving your own problem, which is that, like, it's good to talk to customers. It's good to browse forums and read what people are saying. It's good to learn how to do that research. And if you get too comfortable solving your own problem, then it's really easy to use that as an excuse to just, like, believe in your own intuition and to assume that everybody's exactly like you and that you have the perfect vision. When the reality is that, like, even if you're solving your own problem, it's very often the case that, like, you're off. Like, then the hackers are solving my own problem. I wanted to come up with business ideas. But, like, it wasn't my idea that every interview should have revenue numbers. Like, that was from things that people on Hacker News were saying and complaining about. Like, I never would have thought about that. So it's not good enough just to solve your own problem. Like, you also need to talk to people. And that's something that always has to happen if you want to have, like, a really good product that matches with what other people want. For entering a crowded market, I think, like, so the other side, like, the other draw of, like, I guess the other side of the spectrum of solving your own problem is, like, being opportunistic. Like, okay, I've seen a gap in the market. I think I can exploit this gap. There's, like, some sort of way I can wedge my business into this, like, you know, this hole and create this arbitrage opportunity, or, like, you know, fill this thing that no one else is doing. I am, like, I'm increasingly against doing that. And I'll tell you why. I think that represents kind of a scarcity mentality. Specifically scarcity with regard to ideas. Like, the only reason to do that is if you believe that you can't also come up with an idea that's something that you're genuinely interested in, that is in a space that you like and enjoy, that also is similarly, like, promising. If you think that's really hard to do, then of course you're gonna look for all these opportunistic ideas that are in spaces that you don't enjoy. But here's the thing, like, I think the space of good ideas is infinite. I think no matter what you're interested in, there's, like, an infinite number of really good ideas there that, like, you could find with a little bit of work. I think it's worth it to brute force ideas and to sit down and to really work through them and just be frustrated at coming up with bad ideas until you get a good one. But I think it's not worth it to opportunistically come up with an idea for a business in a market or an industry that you don't understand and that you don't even really like, and then have to learn all about it. And then, like, worst case scenario, your business fails. But then best case scenario, like, you build a successful business and lock yourself into working on something that you don't care about for many years, and you're not even that happy. And, like, you end up in this, like, very predictable situation where, like, you just want to quit your own business years down the road. Even though it seems exciting to you now, it's, like, no longer exciting once, like, you've gotten used to it. So I would say, like, have some constraints, like, have your own, like, validation checklist. And, like, your constraint should basically be to include, like, you only working on things that you're genuinely interested in. Like, there can be things that you don't know about, you know, like, I'm interested in fiction and storytelling, and I don't know a lot about it. I've never been an author. And so if I went into that industry, I'd have to learn a lot, but at least I'd be interested in it. So I wouldn't say, like, you should limit yourself to things you know about, but, like, definitely limit yourself to things that you're genuinely interested in, and don't chase opportunistic gaps in the market that you don't care about. Like, there's gonna be ideas in the spaces that you're interested in. So just constrain yourself to that. Don't even consider looking outside of that, and you'll find something good eventually.
Got a question from Karthik in the chat. He wants to know about market validation, whether there's other channels besides emails, phone calls that are worth it, specifically ads like Google or Facebook.
Yeah, ads work. In fact, ads are kind of, like, the most tried and true way to validate your idea. And I've interviewed, like, dozens of people who validated their idea with ads. So the podcast that just came out this Monday is with Justin Mayers. He tried, like, something like 24 ideas in the span of a year. And the best one was an idea where he was basically spending $5 a day on Google ads for it. And it was making $100 to $150 a day, selling basically a product that did not exist through Google ads. And his product was, like, bone broth, basically, because he's on the keto diet and he's a very healthy eater and he hated making his own bone broth. And he figured other people might want the same. So he put up an ad for it and a ton of people bought it. And that told him it was a good idea. And it ended up being a good idea. And he does make all of his revenue basically from advertising. So he, like, sort of acquires customers. So, like, ads are a totally good user acquisition test. I would say that one thing that people don't realize is that when you're validating your idea, like, I could talk about this for so long. The short version of it is like, you don't want to test, you don't want to validate your idea by testing a distribution channel that's different than the channel that you would ultimately use to grow. Like, if you're using ads to test your business to see if it's going to work, then like, you should also think that like, ads are the way that your business is going to grow indefinitely. Like, if you're doing cold emails to reach people, you should also think that cold emails are what's going to help you grow indefinitely. If you're doing something that like, is completely mismatched, then you're probably going to run into issues down the road where this channel stops working for you. And that's not the worst thing in the world. Like, eventually almost every growth channel stops working. That's kind of like the dirty secret of growth channels. Like, you eventually hit the point of diminishing returns. You're getting in the front page of Hacker News too often and the mods cut you off, right? You've saturated Facebook or Google with your ads and now your ad rates are going up. You have to find a different channel. And like, that happens to almost everybody. You know, you've covered all the store shelves in Whole Foods. It kind of happens to almost every business. But you want that to last as long as possible. And so I would make sure you try to like, you try to test the best ad channel for what you think your long-term growth is going to be. And I would also say that like, you can't, you know, sort of a corollary to this is you can't get discouraged if like, you try a particular channel to validate an idea and that channel doesn't work, if there's other channels that might work. So I've seen people put up like ads for something and the ads don't get a lot of clicks. I'm like, oh, this idea is a bad idea. But like, someone else is working that exact same idea and like, they're making millions of dollars. So it's obviously not a bad idea. Like, your test just didn't work either because you tested the wrong channel, most likely. Like, maybe you should have just tested it by using cold emails, right? Maybe that was just the best thing. You didn't need to get fancy, or because your landing page really sucked. The other thing I would say for validating ideas is like, I kind of want to like draw a picture. Hold on one second. The short version of it is that like, an idea is not just a product idea. So a lot of times someone will like make a landing page and it'll explain like a product and they'll be like, oh, this is my idea. But in my opinion, like, you've got like four different things. Like, you've got your product. That's one part of your business, but it's like a small part of your business. And if you come up with an idea for a product, like, that is not a business idea. That's just a product idea. You've also got like, your market. So who is buying this? Like, what do they care about? What are they like? Where do they live? How savvy are they? You know, do you know about them? What alternatives do they use? Like, the market, basically. Like, is this a growing market? Is it a shrinking market? Like, that's another sort of pillar besides the product. Everyone kind of knows about those two. There's also distribution channels. So it's like kind of the third pillar. It's like a third wheel. This is like, how do you reach that market? It doesn't really matter if there's a market of people if you don't have a way to get to them. And then like, fourth would be like your sort of pricing. All four of these need to work together. Like, they all need to work in concert. And a business idea is something that encapsulates all four of these things together. And it kind of sounds like a lot, but it's actually not that many things. It's just four things. And so like, the thing I want to draw is like my sort of mental model, which I didn't realize until like a few months ago. Like, this is how I envision it in my head. And I've never seen anyone else sort of like describe it this way, but I just look at it as almost like four wheels on a car. And then you've got like your product wheel and your market wheel and your channels wheel and your pricing wheel. And they're all connected, right? So product market fit, like, does your product fit your market? Like, that's that kind of axle. Like, market channel fit, right? Do you like the channel that you like? If the channel you like is Hacker News, because you're really good at Hacker News and you really understand like how to get on Hacker News, does the market who's going to buy your product also hang out on Hacker News? If they don't, like, you've got a situation that you have to resolve. Like, pricing channel fit, like, does the pricing of your product allow you to reach that channel? Like, if your channel is sales, that means you have to hire salespeople. Salespeople are expensive. If you're selling your product for $5 a month, like, it doesn't work, right? And then product pricing fit, which is like, can you profitably build your product for the price that you're charging? So all these wheels are connected. And the reason why it's useful to look at it as like wheels on a car is because a lot of people will like put all of their effort into one wheel. Like, my product is just so good. It's amazing. You know, it's an excellent market. But like, you need all four wheels. If you have like three amazing wheels and like one of them is flat, like, your car is not going anywhere. It's better to have four mediocre wheels than it is to have like one really good wheel. And so like, you could torture this metaphor if you want. Like, this whole thing is like a car. And then like, the execution layer is like you sitting on top driving. Like, how good are you at driving the car? It's kind of how I look at it. But like, execution versus idea. Execution is you driving this car. But like, the idea is like, do you have all four of these components working? And if these components are not in harmony, your business idea is going to be crappy. And it doesn't matter how good of an executor you are, you're not going to be able to have a good business idea. The other good thing about this model and thinking about it like this way is that it kind of makes it easy for you to figure out like what the challenges are in front of you for your business. And so if you're like, man, my product is like really high quality, I've got an amazing designer and developer and we tested it with users and they like find it so easy to use. And like, the market is really good. It's like growing and getting bigger. And the people there are like really like have a specific pain point and the product market fit is good. Like, my product solves that pain point, but like, you know, the distribution channel is like the wheel that's flat. Like, you know, to spend most of your time on the distribution channel, you don't have to spend your time tweaking your product. And a lot of times people who don't have this model, who like the only thing in their mind is product, like they're like, oh, I'm not growing. My numbers aren't going up. I need to add more features to my product. I need to make the product better, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I've seen people enter that death spiral for years where they're just adding more features and making their product better. And it turns out like your product is good. You just haven't hit on a good distribution channel yet. Like, or your product is like good and your distribution channel is good, but like, you know, you're getting to the top of Hacker News every day, but like no one's converting because like the market isn't really there. And so you need to like work on that part of your business. So I would say like, think about those four things in concert and always be asking yourself, like, you know, do they fit together really well? You know, is the price right for your market? Is like the product right for this channel, et cetera? And just make like little incremental tweaks. And probably the biggest thing you can do is just look at others. Like, generally speaking, you're probably not the only person with your business idea unless you're super niche. And so you can see what channels are working for them. Like, what kind of market is working for them? Like, what kind of pricing is working for them? The more niche you are, the more novel you are, the fewer examples you will have. And then the last thing I'll say on this is like, every one of these wheels of your business has competition. So like, there's going to be competition for your market. There's going to be competition for your product. There's going to be competition for these channels. There's going to be competition for the pricing. And like, your business is going to have to stand out like somehow. Like, it has to have some give somewhere. So like, if you're entering a place where like the market is really crowded, there's tons of competitors, and the channels are really crowded, like everyone's already bidding up all the ads on Google for this. And the pricing is really competitive. Like, everyone is like charging very little. Then like, the only place where you can stand out is product. Like, you have to have a killer product in that situation. Otherwise, you're not going to get recommended. So someone earlier talked about the podcast, just like growing a podcast. The podcast is a good example of a business I would analyze like that, where it's like, market saturated, tons of podcasts, channels are saturated, tons of podcast players, no real way to get your thing promoted to the top of those channels, super competitive. Pricing is competitive. It's all free. Like, the only possible give with the podcast is the quality of the product. Like, you have to make your podcast better. It's really hard to find a better distribution channel than the ones that already exist. Whereas with Justin Mayer's company, he had the Kettle and Fire, the bone broth company, he was sort of iterating on like a bunch of different fronts. And so like, he had like channel innovation. Like, he was one of the first people to start using Instagram influencers to recommend his product. So he just got all these health food influencers. This is like 5 or 6 years ago when Instagram was like super new, and he had like no competition in the distribution channel space. So even if he had like a kind of a crappy product, or like, even if the market wasn't growing that well, or even if his pricing was really expensive, like, he was super competitive in the channel. And so he was like way better, and he could have like built a successful business, even though he didn't have a good product and all the other stuff. So I would say like, look at all your different wheels of your startup car and figure out like, okay, which one of these wheels like are really competitive and which ones are not. And the ones that are not competitive are the ones where you have to like stand out. But you have to stand out in at least one of them. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer. But I've been wanting to like communicate this idea, and you guys are like my guinea pigs for communicating it.
I've never heard of it that way. And that's incredibly useful, because there's always, like you said, the talk about product market fit. And here it's relating everything, where it's like, how are you going to get customers to the door, and are they going to be willing to pay for this problem that you're solving? So yeah, thank you, Corlin. That was awesome.
Yeah, product market fit's not enough. Like, there's so many people who have like a really good product for a really good market, but it's like they just can't grow because they can't afford the Facebook ads. They can't find the channel. So like, I'll say one more thing about it too. Generally, if you're coming up with a business idea, like, you can look at this thing before you write a line of code, before you build anything. Like with Indie Hackers, I was thinking about this in the beginning, not as well formulated, because I kind of came up with this sort of analogy later on. But like, one of the things in my validation checklist was like, I suck at marketing. I suck at growth. Everything I've ever done, I feel like I built a pretty good product. I've got that thing down. Like, I could stand out on the product side, but I really suck at like distributing it. So like, I refuse to allow myself to build anything unless I already know the distribution channel. And so the reason I was excited about that particular idea is because I already knew the distribution channel would be Hacker News. And I was already comfortable with Hacker News because I spent so much time there, but I can kind of know with some reasonable degree of certainty that it's possible for me to get to the top of it. And then I think once you start with like the hard parts of your business, like, what's hard for you? Like, is it the market? Like, you don't know like how to find people. Like, the market's hard for a lot of people. A lot of people have a product and you're like, who's it for? They're like, everyone. And it's like, okay, so you don't know who your market is, right? Or is like, you ask me who Indie Hackers is for, I'm like, for developers who want to start side projects or profitable businesses. You know, it's like a very specific group. So like, market's hard for you, or the channel's hard for you, or whatever's hard for you. Start there, try to get that figured out, like in theory, and then always like work backwards from there to do the other things. And so like, if you already, like, if you're good at product, like, don't start with the product, start with the market. Figure out what the market wants, and then use that to determine what kind of product you build. And that'll make the market thing way easier because your product will be like specifically tailored to that market. I think a lot of people just like start with the product no matter what. And then they try to like shove their product into like the hole where like the, so whatever distribution channel or whatever market, it doesn't fit because they didn't craft their product from the ground up to fit. So you got to figure out the hard parts first and then work backwards to do the parts that are easier for you.
Could I jump in with another question since we're talking about distribution? Yeah. So one thing I feel like I've listened to so many of the interviews, but I don't feel like I hear talked about, and it seems very like a really powerful lever is like kind of becoming an influencer for lack of a better way to put it. But like you, Cortland, like you're actually a great use case because from what I understand, you have a twin brother that's also working on this on Indie Hackers. But like you're the face of it. You're this like known entity now within the community. And there's a lot of, you can create your own distribution channel, like whatever you want to do next, assuming it's somehow adjacent or within the same space, you can just start it and people are going to be interested in what Cortland's doing. And so like you're kind of your own, when you have a soapbox or an audience or a list or whatever, like you can become your own distribution channel in some ways. That's why celebrities can like start a business and like flip a switch and then all of a sudden they have customers. Now, obviously, most of your community, most of the Indie Hackers community doesn't have anything like that. But can you speak to like whether am I overstating it or how do you see it, given that you've gone from anonymous to kind of this, you know, you have a personal brand now?
Yeah. So the top of the car that I didn't really talk about as much, I just talked about the four wheels, but it's like it's you sitting on this car driving these four wheels, whatever. That's the execution level. There's also like you might have heard of like founder product fit. Like how much do you fit in with particular things? So you can imagine like a line connecting you to each of those four wheels. Like how much do you like this product? How much do you like this market and the customers in it? How much do you like these distribution channels? For me personally, like I don't like trying to be an influencer. I like sitting around in my apartment, writing code and hanging out with my friends. A lot of people love it. Like that's their favorite thing. They just want to be a public figure. They want to go to speaking gigs and give talks all the time and be on TV. And like, that's their favorite thing too. So I think there's like a kind of a founder channel fit line going on there where like you have to like what you're doing, but it's a totally valid way to grow your business. We don't talk about it in terms of being an influencer as much in sort of the Indie Hackers niche. We mostly use the phrase like build your audience, build an audience, like create a following around what you're doing, but it's mostly like becoming an influencer, right? Like get more Twitter followers, build an email list, do something where people like actually care about who you are and what you're up to, and then you can take them with you to other places. So there are people who like a couple podcast episodes I'd maybe recommend listening to, like Peter Levels does a really good job at this. So does Wes Boss. And so does Adam Wavin. Like they're all really good at building audiences for themselves and becoming like sort of brand names on Twitter. And like the way that they do that, Ben Ornstein's also a good one from Tuple. The way that they do that is like, there's a pretty straightforward formula, which is like been articulated by Patio 11, be helpful on the internet. The way that you build an audience around yourself, especially like in the modern day, is you just like give helpful things to people. That's incredibly rare. Most people don't have anything to offer, or they do have something to offer, but they don't know how to put it out, or they do know how to put it out, but they don't want to. They just sort of greedily hoard it. Whereas like all of these people to a T are super helpful. So they'll go on Twitter and their Twitter account will be like them spending hours crafting tweets to explain coding concepts to people and to give people tips about growing their businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And they accrue followings because like, why wouldn't you follow someone who's constantly helping you and giving you amazing information? Probably the one exception of those four or five that I listed is Peter Levels, who I wouldn't say spends a ton of time being helpful. But like, then again, like he did inspire me to start my business because he was in the comments on Hacker News sharing all the details behind how he started his business over and over again. So like he did have a phase where that was his primary thing. But nowadays, like mostly what he does is he just builds in public. So this is kind of the second way to build an audience. I think building in public is incredibly captivating to people. It's almost like an indirect way of being helpful because everyone wants to know like, how's everyone else doing it, right? No one kind of wants to like let people look behind the scenes of their like super hacky ghetto process for doing things because we're all kind of embarrassed. But like people like Peter Levels, a guy has no shame. He'll tweet every single unfinished design that he has, all of his opinions without caring about being judged. And like, he'll just like tweet the whole process and like thought process behind every single change he makes to his website. And people love it because it's super helpful to see like how he's doing things and chime in and feel like you're a part of it. So he like is really good at growing his audience that way. That's something else I wanted to say about it. Like, as far as utility goes, there's like, it's mixed. Some businesses, like being an influencer is just, it's that third wheel, right? It's distribution, right? It's how do you reach people by being an influencer. It's not who do you reach, that's the market. It's not like what are you reaching them with, that's the product. It's how are you getting to people. Like every other business, you have to figure out like how does this wheel connect to the other wheels in harmony so the car actually runs well, right? Not all businesses are really propelled by being an influencer. So if you have kind of a lifestyle brand where you're like selling health and wellness, people really love following you and seeing that you're fit and that you can take care of your body. So like Instagram is a good channel for you. You could be a good influencer and you could sell health brands. If you're trying to sell like a developer tool to developers, being an influencer is not quite as useful. Developers are going to care that the tool is actually good. And if they use it and it's crap and it doesn't work, then like they're probably not going to use your tool no matter how famous you are. So there's a whole spectrum. Like we all know products that like are sold by influencers that are garbage for the people who use. It can probably help, but like I would say like probably don't go down that path or waste your time unless you're bent on starting a business that's gonna help you there. I talked to another person who's sort of done this, Mike Tabor from MicroConf. He's one of the organizers of MicroConf. He's a huge audience. He's had a blog for like 15 years. He just kept launching these businesses and no one in his audience cared because the businesses that he launched didn't align with what his audience wanted. And so again, like it's not about just having one wheel on this car, like it also fit in with all the other wheels. And like, you can just think about that. So those are my thoughts. I think it's like, it's good, but you don't necessarily have to do it. It's optional. The advice to build an audience gets trotted out a lot. I say it a lot, but like I didn't have an audience before building Indie Hackers. I got my audience from building Indie Hackers. And so I wouldn't say it's like a precursor to starting a business, depending on whether or not you have other distribution channels that you can use to grow.
It seems like a long-term career, like a very long-term strategy for your entire career. So maybe you don't need it for this Indie Hackers business you're thinking about. It would help, but maybe you don't need it. But now whatever second and third business you do, assuming again, it's within the space or something your audience is interested in, I assume there'll be serious dividends there.
Yeah. So the way I think about this is you can like torture this business car metaphor even more is that as you're driving the car that is your business, you're sometimes accruing different wins. Like you get better at different things. You get more users, you make more money, you make more friends, you build your audience. And like every advantage you accrue can then be used to make getting to the next level a little bit easier. So Rob Walling, he calls it the stair-step approach, right? Don't jump to the top of the staircase all at once. Like take one step at a time. And like when you take a step that makes you like a little bit higher. So now the second step is easier to reach than it was. And a business is the same way. So you're totally right. Like you build an audience, like that audience is not something that just like goes away and provides no advantage. Like that's like taking a step on the staircase. And now anything you want to do later on is slightly easier because you've taken that first step and made it a little bit higher. Sort of like the flip side of this is like why it's so important to think this way is that one of the biggest founder mistakes is biting off way too much in the beginning. Right, having this grand vision for this amazing product and this amazing business and just trying to just get there in one fell swoop, which is why some people spend like a year coding a product, right? Where it's like actually easier to get somewhere big if you start really small and iteratively and like, you know, you start your blog and your blog gets you some newsletter subscribers and newsletter subscribers feed your podcast and your podcast gives you the clout to bring on interesting guests and the interesting guests enter you to investors and those investors give you like, it's like one thing leads to another and makes it better and better. Building an audience and like being an influencer is one of those things. There's a whole wide array. I've seen so many people accrue these different advantages with their businesses and then leverage those advantages to get like other advantages and like open the door to opportunities that never would have been opened if they didn't start somewhere smaller and start accruing things. For me personally, I don't think I'll probably use my audience that much because like I don't have like a really good like personal fit for like trying to be some sort of influencer celebrity type person. I don't even like tweeting really. But that's just me personally. But there's other like advantages that I accrue from Indie Hackers that like I think a lot about, like how I could parlay that into some future win and like where how that can help me in the future. So there's a whole lot of them.
We got time for one last question if anybody wants to jump in.
I guess I could go. You mentioned about these Google ads that people have been utilizing to validate their idea. And I feel like I'm just doing this wrong because every time I go on to try these ad channels, I hear these stories about people spending $5 a day. But every time I look at these keywords, they're all charging between, you know, almost like $5 per click. So how are, you know, people going about this?
So this is what I was talking about earlier, which is like channel decay. Almost every growth strategy stops working over time. This is why it's bad to copy like a business idea that you've seen people writing about for like 10 years because it's probably really saturated now. And competition like kills businesses. Like if you read the book Zero to One by Peter Thiel, he talks about it. It's kind of a book dedicated to like high growth startups, but applies to literally everyone. The idea is always the same. It's even this little sort of like car analogy that I've been drawing, where like there's too much competition in three of the wheels, you have to be stand out on another wheel. There's just a lot of competition for ads. And if you're looking at places where like people are spending like hundreds of dollars to reach a customer and it's saturated with all these like competitors, that's probably not a very good market for you to enter, because the distribution channel is really competitive. Or you just have to stack it up and like pay that much money and innovate in some other way. So those people who are able to do that profitably, it's because they have some, like one of the other wheels in their car is like super competitive and they're winning that way, right? Maybe their product is like super good, or maybe they have a ton of like, maybe their pricing doesn't matter because they have a ton of VC funding, so they can like charge low and compete on pricing. Or, you know, maybe their market is better because they have like some sort of like lock on a particular niche that you don't see behind the scenes. This is like not a new phenomenon. Like if you hear people talk about Google Ads in the early days, like one of my first podcast guests was David Hauser, who started Grasshopper, which is like one of these old school SaaS companies from like 2000. And back then, advertising was something like 1 cent per click. And that was like a reliable thing. Like people who were super early to the search engine optimization, like search engine ads back in the day, were buying millions of users for like pennies. And like they built huge businesses as a result of that. Like MailChimp got huge because it was like early to a particular distribution channel that now has been like kind of permanently closed off for people who don't find some sort of like other advantage, like a really specific niche, like bone broth to people on the keto diet, because the keto diet is a new trend. And so it's not saturated, right? So I think you have to have like some sort of niche, some sort of new thing. Otherwise you're just gonna be competing. The same thing happens to other channels too. Like Instagram influencers used to be super cheap. Now you wanna advertise with influencers, like the gig's up. It's been going on for like 5 or 6 years now. Like influencers are super expensive just to get like a kind of a crappy influencer. So like a huge part of innovating with distribution channels, if like that's the place where you want to innovate, is like you have to be really early to a new distribution channel, which means you have to really spend a lot of time keeping your ear to the ground. You're like, oh, I hear about TikTok. TikTok's big. People are adopting this. Is that a potentially new distribution channel, et cetera? Or you have to do what I was just saying and like niche down with the market and really say, okay, I'm going to target an old distribution channel that's really saturated, but like some new trend that no one's bidding on keywords for or something like that. Final thing I'll say is like your question was about validating an idea. Like it really depends like what part of your idea you're trying to validate. Again, like you're trying to validate like that the product is a good one. In that case, who cares how much the keyword cost in Google? Just spend the money and see if people like your product, right? You're trying to validate like that the market is who you think the market is. In that case, again, like who cares about the pricing? Put the thing on Google, like eat the cost, and then like survey the people who click through and figure out like, are these the people who I hypothesized they would be? Do have the same cares and concerns that like I thought they would. Right, but if you're trying to validate the distribution channel as something you can reach profitably, then yeah, if it's super expensive, then that's not going to work for you. And like the vast majority of all business ideas, like don't work. Like all different configurations of product, market, channel, and pricing. Like for every million, you know, of those configurations, like only one of them is a good business idea. So most smoke tests you put up on Google are not going to work. But there's still like an infinite number of good business ideas, like a 10 times infinity number of bad business ideas. So. I would say just because it doesn't work doesn't mean like it can't work. It's just you've got to find the right combination.
Great. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks again, Cortland, for coming and being here with us at Worldwide today. Thanks for everybody that came and asked questions. This was a really fun meetup to do. And tomorrow sometime we'll upload this as a recording in case you missed part of it or want to share it with a friend that couldn't make it. And in about 3 weeks, we've got Rosie Sherry, the founder of Ministry of Test.
Sweet. Rosie's awesome.
Yeah. You should come back, Cortland.
I'll come watch Rosie's for sure.
The link is in the chat if anybody wants to RSVP now. And it's going to be on Zoom again, just like this. So hopefully see some of you guys on October 1st. But note that the time is in London time. So convert that to wherever you are.
I'm gonna pitch you guys really quickly on the Indie Hackers Milestones. It's a newish feature on the site. So if you haven't, I highly recommend basically posting milestones on Indie Hackers. So the way it works is you create a product page. Whenever something happens with your product, like you find your first customer, you learn something new, like any sort of milestone at all, make a little post about it. It could be super short, it could take you 10 minutes. And I advise you to make your post educational. Like say what you did, but also say like what you learned and how you got there. Post it on the milestones page around 12 a.m. midnight PST, it resets. I'm trying to drive as much traffic as I can to like the best, highest quality milestones. If you guys post really good milestones, I'll try to help you out, or Rosie will as well if she sees them, and you can get some traffic. Like Indie Hackers is a good example of like a ideally, if all goes well, like a very early stage distribution channel where there's not that many people paying attention to it and it's pretty small, but it's growing. And so there's not that much competition and it's free. There are certain people who are, Rune and Vulcan's growth hack here. there's certain people who are really good at it. Vulcan's good at it. Harry Dry, who I just had on the Indicators podcast, he's super good at it. He posts like some of the best milestones I've seen where he's not just like, hey, I hit 5,000 Twitter followers. this is what happens. Vulcan, you gotta leverage your traffic while you can get it before it gets crowded. But like he'll post like, I got 1,000 Twitter followers, and then he'll have like a whole breakdown of how he got there. And that's why his milestone posts get to the top of the leaderboard every time, because he's actually being super helpful. So he's like combining working in public, but also being helpful on the internet. And like, I think most people post milestones like, hey, I just did this thing. And everyone says, congrats, but no one really learned anything from it. So they're not motivated to upvote. So I would recommend that you like try using this thing. It's like a really good way to practice being helpful on the internet and sharing what you're working on. If you're building something that sort of targets a niche of other people like you who are founders trying to build successful businesses. And here's like a hint, like, targeting other businesses is usually the best business model. Then it could also potentially be a good distribution channel for you to get some of your earliest customers, a few dozens or hundreds of clicks to your product. So that's my one little ad that I'll put in at the end here.
Awesome. Yeah, if anyone's somehow here but not yet on indiehackers.com, go check that out as well. And if you're watching this on YouTube, maybe you haven't heard of it. So link in the description. Awesome. Yeah, thanks everybody for being here. Thank you so much, Corlin. And have a great whatever time of day it is where you are.
All right. Thanks, everybody.